from my side, for those of you who are new here, I'm not the regular preacher guy. Don't worry. As Nico said, Johan is in Israel at the moment, and he asked me to do a talk on animal rights because of Cecil the Lion. I don't know how many of you remember Cecil the Lion. It's been a while. I told him it's way too long, but he wanted a talk on Cecil the Lion, and the 6th of December was open. So we are talking about animal rights this evening, and the title Johan chose was hashtag Animal Lives Matter, for those of you who are familiar with the Black Lives Matter thing in the U.S. Yeah. So in preparing this talk, I asked a couple of people about what they thought the Bible said about animals, and since then, I've spoken to one or two people who might be slightly more enlightened, but most of the people I spoke to thought that animal rights or animals in the Bible, they fell into two categories. The first category was people who thought that the Bible said that we could do this with animals as we please, and they're okay with that because we can hunt and eat them and do whatever we like. And the second group said that the Bible says that we can do with animals as we please, and they're not okay with that, and they're slightly uncomfortable. Culture has moved on since then, and we've recognized the fact that we might have to care about animals. And I kind of fell into the second group as well until I actually started doing some research on this. And I'd like to say a few things by way of introduction. The first thing is that even if the Bible didn't say anything about animals, I think it would still be pretty clear what the Christian ethic around that should be, because the Bible isn't a rule book about just do this and don't do this, and since there's no rule in the Bible about hitting a badger with a stick, it should be okay to hit a badger with a stick, because there's no verse against that, right? So it doesn't work like that. The Bible as a whole talks more about becoming the kinds of people who would naturally and easily do certain things, about cultivating beautiful souls and educating our souls to love goodness. I'm not saying that there aren't rules or, you know, murder is wrong or other things, but when you look at the big picture, people try to reduce it to, you know, if there's a verse about this, then it's okay or not okay, and it doesn't work like that. If the Bible is about man's relationship with God, primarily, and animals feature every now and then as that speaks to man's relationship with God, but it's not an animal rights textbook. And if you are expecting it to be an animal rights textbook, then you'll be disappointed. But that was never the intention of it. And unfortunately, this has led to a kind of what the theologian Richard Balcom, who wrote a book on this, he calls it the anthropocentric fantasy, the human-centered fantasy. And that's this fantasy that God can only relate to animals through humans. That's because that's what we read about in the Bible, right? Humans and animals and God. So some people think that God can only relate to animals through humans, and that's obviously completely false. There are a lot of questions that we can't answer from the Bible. For example, are other creatures aware of God? Maybe in ways that we don't know of, we have no experience of. We don't know. What's happening in the furthest reaches of the universe, according to God? We don't know. Doesn't say. Is evil at work in animals also, or only in humans? The Bible doesn't talk about that. But it does talk about a whole lot of other things, and I've had to, I thought I'd put in all the verses, but my slideshow got to like 50 slides, and I saw that I had to cut down because I was only halfway. So I've got about a third of the interesting things that the Bible says about animals in here. And there's a lot, so we'll have to move to get through it. But it was pretty cool. I think it's quite interesting, and we can talk about it till the cows come home, but we'll only do these couple of slides this evening. My claim is, the next slide, a Wendell Berry quote. By the end, you can say if you agree with this or not. Wendell Berry is a Christian writer and poet. He said, "The ecological teaching of the Bible is simply inescapable. God made the world because he wanted it made. He thinks that the world is good, and he loves it. It is his world. He has never relinquished title to it, and he has never revoked the conditions bearing on his gift to us for the use of it, which oblige us to take excellent care of it. The ecological teaching of the Bible is simply inescapable. That's the idea. And let's see if we can, if I can motivate this this claim this evening. Now, we have to have a plan. This is the plan. As Mr. T said, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail, fool. So this is the plan. We're going to talk about the Bible for the first two-thirds, creation, fall, redemption, the big story of the Bible, how the world was created, the fall and the consequences of sin, and redemption, Christian hope. And then for the second half of the talk, or the second third of the talk, we'll do applications. We'll look at naturalism and speciesism, animal versus human charity, hunting, and eating animals. Now, I know for many of you, there's this elephant in the room, and that is animal sacrifice. And you're like, yeah. Just get to the bit about animal sacrifice, because that really bothers people. So we'll get to that. Hold your horses. But first, we have to go through creation and those kind of things first to put this in the context of the big story. Okay, so a good place to start is in the beginning with Genesis. So I'll read to you a pretty lengthy bit of Genesis 1, which kind of sets the scene. And listen to it carefully. There are many things that are happening here that we'll speak about later. Listen to this carefully. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over the livestock, over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God made man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and be responsible for it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. So, this is pretty interesting. Did that come up here? Oh, right. Okay, so this is the story of, a bit of the story on creation. If you are still wondering whether it's 24-hour days or like 1,000-year days or whatever, then you've completely missed the point of the story. To get back, I skipped a slide. When looking at the Bible, we'll look at creation, fall, and redemption. Under creation, I've got these three themes. The first one is that God creates all the animals, including humans, and that humans and animals share the same life. Then we'll look at the humans are to reign like God, and God's reign means he cares tenderly and generously for all of creation. And then lastly, some loose ends. God owns all animals. God models good animal care, and humans are to know and care for the animals. And then we'll look at fall and redemption, and we'll expand that when we get there. Getting back to the Genesis 1 bit. Michael Bullmore is a theologian who's written extensively on animal rights, and he has an interesting thing to say about Genesis 1. He says, and this is a quote that's on the slides. Go on. Next one. There we go. Each individual animal is a unique testimony of grace. All God's creatures were made with wisdom and have the ability to speak to man of that wisdom. The loss of every unique species is a diminution of man's opportunity to observe the perfection of God. So this is still under the heading, God creates all creatures. Okay, and we read about that, and this is, I think, a good explanation of that. The next one is that humans and animals share the same nefesh, the same life. Now, nefesh in the Old is a Hebrew word that means life, soul, personality. In Greek, it would be psuche, which is translated in the New Testament as soul. Love your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, with all your psuche, with all your nefesh. That's that which animates us. And animals share man's nefesh. Every living thing has a nefesh, has the breath of life. That's kind of the Old Testament way of saying it. So the depressive philosopher in Ecclesiastes has this fun passage in there that says, I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they are themselves but animals. For whatever happens to the children of man and what happens to the animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beasts, the animals, goes down into the earth? I think that's fun. Obviously, the writer of Ecclesiastes has taken a bit of poetic license here, because he, I don't think, believes that the humans and animals are exactly the same. But this is a good reminder that we do share something in common with the animals, this nefesh, this breath of life. And we'll get back to that a bit later. The second point on this is that humans are to rule in God's likeness. Right? There's a lot has been said about the humans have dominion over the animals, humans should rule over the animals, and I think that's been abused in the past. But just to remind ourselves, we just read this, but from Genesis, look at the relationship between being made in the image of God and ruling. And then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over everything, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So being there's something, some link here between ruling over nature and being made in the image of God. Now, John Austin Baker, the Bishop of Salisbury, had the following to say about this, because, and I'm sorry about all the quotes and all the verses, but if I don't put them up, then people won't believe me, because this has been so ingrained in our culture. John Austin Baker says, the dominion which man is promised in Genesis 1 is poles apart from the kind of right to egotistical exploitation which it suggests to our ears. It is, in essence, a perfect obedience to the will of God, which is rewarded by a divinely ordained harmony and abundance in nature, which recognizes man as the greatest of all God's creatures and pays him homage. This dominion or rule that's being spoken of here is not the right to do with it what you want, but rather the responsibility to care for it tenderly and generously. So let's look at the way in which God rules over creation. That would give us a model for how how we are to rule over creation. And let's start with Psalm 36, verse 5. Your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, and your faithfulness to the clouds. Your righteousness is like the mountains of God, and your judgments are like the great deep. Man and beast you save, O Lord. So this is quite interesting, because in the Old Testament, salvation, being saved, is about more than simply having your sins forgiven and going to heaven when you die. Salvation is about the restoration of shalom, the harmony of nature, the abundance of nature, that's the idea. So when the New Testament speaks of salvation, they usually have an Old Testament idea of salvation in mind. That's not to say it's not about forgiveness of sins and heaven and all those things, but it's a much broader term than how it's generally conceptualized in our minds. Next verse, Psalm 145, verses 9 to 11. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he has made. All your works shall give you praise, shall give you thanks, O Lord, and your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and tell of your power. So if animals could talk today, do you think animals would speak of the glory of the human kingdom and tell of our power? Do you think that this is the way humans have ruled in the likeness of God over all of creation? I don't think so. The next one is Jesus in Luke 12, verse 6. Are not five sparrows sold for two pennies, and not one of them is forgotten before God? The most insignificant creature in the creation in the Creator's creation is remembered in front of the Creator. And so, and then Jesus goes on to say, how much more than us who are not the least of the creatures, like five sparrows sold for two pennies. But there's still something here about, are there animals that are forgotten before man? Maybe in a factory chicken farm with 1,000 chickens in a big closed-off area, and yet not one of them is forgotten before God. The last one for this rule of God is from Jonah, and you can blank that out for now, Ram. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the story of Jonah. It's really funny. We all know about the fish episode, right? But what happens is, God comes to Jonah, who's a prophet in Israel, and he says to him, go to Nineveh and tell them that they must repent and I'll forgive them for their sins. And that's a bit like telling a Frenchman to go to ISIS and tell them to repent, and then God will forgive them of their sins. So it took Jonah about a second to decide, and he gets on a boat and he goes in the opposite direction, Tarshish, right? Geographically, the other way. So there's a storm, he gets swallowed by the fish, he gets spat out on the shores of Nineveh, and now he's there, and I think with great hesitation and not much enthusiasm, he walks through Nineveh and tells them that they will be overthrown if they don't repent. And to his great horror, every last person in Nineveh repents, right? They all turn to God, the whole of ISIS, whatever, turns to God. And Jonah gets very angry. And he says to God, you see, I told you that this was going to happen. I said this to myself when I was fleeing to Tarshish, that you are a God that is merciful and with steadfast love, and that you'll forgive them. And he gets very angry. So he goes outside the city and he sits down, and the sun beats down on him, and he's not a happy camper. So this God causes this plant to grow up over him to give him shade, to teach him a lesson. And the plant grows up over him, and Jonah gets happy. But then God appoints a worm, and the worm eats the plant, and this is where we come in the story. When the sun rose, when the sun rose, God appointed a scorching east wind, and the sun beat down on the head of Jonah so that he was faint. And he asked that he might die, and said, it is better for me to die than to live. It is so hot that I want to die. If you thought it was hot today, Or maybe Jonah would have said the same thing. But God said to Jonah, "Do you do well to be angry for the plant?" And Jonah says, "Yes, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die." And the Lord says, "You pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. Should I not pity Nineveh, that great city, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who don't know their right hand from their left, and also many animals?" And that's the last verse in Jonah, "and also many animals," which is weird, right? But what's God trying to teach Jonah here? He says, you are angry over this plant, which is just a plant, and it lived for a whole day, and then it died. Should I not be compassionate over this great city with all these people who have no idea what they're doing, and also all these animals? Right? I have compassion over them, on them, because I made them, and it took more than a day to do that. Nineveh wasn't built in a day, apparently. That's what God is saying here. So God's reign over creation means that he cares tenderly and generously for all of his creation. He probably even cares about Isis and Isis's animals, despite the evil that's going on there. The next one, God owns all animals. Psalm 50, verses 10 to 12. "For every beast in the forest is mine," this is God speaking, "the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know all the birds of the hills, and all that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and its fullness are mine." This is in the context of Old Testament sacrifice. He says, "I don't want your sacrifices. I own all the animals. I wouldn't tell you if I needed a sacrifice." But we'll get to that a bit later. So God owns all the animals. In Genesis 2, verse 15, it says, "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it." So if you have a gardener, you put the gardener in your garden and you give him dominion over your garden so that he may work it and keep it, right? If you come home from work one day and you find that he has slaughtered your dog and he's brying it, would you be happy with him? No, it's not his dog. It's your dog. He has no right to kill it, to slaughter it and eat it. Even though you gave him dominion over your garden, it means he is responsible for your garden. It doesn't mean that he can do with it what he pleases. Now, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is a Jewish commentator who said that there is nothing nearer to idolatry than forgetting that all things belong to God. And by the way, this is why we sin against God when we sin against people, right? When I hurt my fellow human being, I sin against him, but I also sin against God, because God's his creator and he belongs to God, right? And it's the same thing when your gardener slaughters your dog. He sins against you as the owner of the dog. It's that kind of idea. Andrew Lindsay is an Oxford professor of theology, and he's kind of one of the intellectual leaders of the Christian animal rights movement. And he has the following to say about this. "Animals are God's creatures, not human property, not utilities, not resources, nor commodities, but precious beings in God's sight. Christians whose eyes are fixed on the awfulness of the crucifixion are in a special position to understand the awfulness of innocent suffering. The cross of Christ is God's absolute identification with the weak, the powerless, and the vulnerable, but most of all, with unprotected, undefended, innocent suffering." So how do we fit this into us eating animals or us hunting or those kind of things? Because there are verses in the Bible that talk about this, and we'll get to that now. But that's something we have to keep in mind. The next short, interesting thing, I thought this was fun, was the British Farm Animal Welfare Council has 5 stipulations for how you should treat your farm animals. And I like these. Maybe, yeah, let's go through them. Freedom from thirst, hunger, and malnutrition. Freedom from discomfort. Freedom from pain, injury, and disease. Freedom to express normal behavior. And freedom from fear and distress. these sound good to me. I don't know how they sound to you. I like them. So keep your eyes on this, and I'll read Psalm 23. It's not on a slide. I'll just read it to you, and you scroll through that. Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. I think it's a good thing that David familiarized himself with the British Farm Animal Welfare Council's stipulations for how to treat his animals before he wrote about God as the Good Shepherd in here. God models good animal care. That's kind of the idea we're getting at here. And it's uncanny how Psalm 23 reads as a kind of poetic version of the stipulations for how to treat your animals. The last one under creation is that humans know the animal's nefesh. Now, there's this proverb, and many of you might know this, which says that whoever is righteous has regard for the life of his animal. Sounds good. But in Hebrew, what it's really saying, and it's difficult to translate, so you can't really blame them, but what it says is that whoever is righteous knows the nefesh of his animal. He yadas the nefesh of his animal, right? He can look into his eyes, and he knows the soul of the animal. He knows when the animal's tired, when the animal's hungry, that kind of thing. The righteous man yadas the nefesh of his animal. Now, this is interesting because in Exodus 23, verse 9, it says, "You shall not oppress the foreigner." This is Moses trying to teach the Israelites not to be rotten people. And it's quite funny because there are a bunch of verses in the Bible where you're like, did he have to tell this to anyone? But you shall not oppress a foreigner in your midst, or a foreigner. You know, you yada the nefesh of the foreigner, for you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. You know what it's like to be a foreigner because you were a foreigner. You can identify with a foreigner. You yada his nefesh. Therefore, don't oppress him. Back to Proverbs 12, verse 10. The righteous man yadas the nefesh of his animal. Interesting. So, Balcom says that this short proverb packs quite a punch, and he writes like a couple of pages on it. But yeah, that's interesting. There, we are able to discern the psychological state of our animals, that kind of thing. There's also a lot about naming and knowing animals. Naming, that when Adam is called to name the animals, it's not on a slide, but it suggests more than just, taxonomy, scientific, you belong to the genus this and the species this and blah, blah, blah. It's more about, in the Old Testament, when you name something, you exercise power over it, but you also discern its spirit, or there's an intimate relationship. You know its name, you know what it's like, you can get to the heart of this creature or this person. Okay, so that was fun. Now we get to the fall. The fall is less fun. Let's start with Genesis 3. I think it's on there. We can skip those. Let's skip those. Let's go on to the fall. The fall is forward of that. Okay, so the fall, we're going to talk about animal sacrifice, eating animals, and animal neglect and abuse. Just to remind ourselves, who's the first person in the Bible to sacrifice an animal? God is. It's slightly uncomfortable. I don't like it, but there it is. Genesis 3, verse 13 and 21. Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done? Who told you that you are naked?" And a bit later, "And the Lord God made for Adam and his wife garments of skins and clothed them." Now, I guess he could have popped skins out of nowhere. I suspect that didn't happen. And this is a an indication, a foretaste of the consequences of disobedience to God or rejecting God, moving away from God, that kind of thing. And it's not nice, and I don't think it was supposed to be nice. We can talk about animal sacrifice now, I think. I don't like it. There are lots of verses in the Old Testament about animal sacrifice. I don't like it. I'm guessing you don't like it. And I'm guessing the Israelites probably didn't like it either. It's gruesome. It's bloody. It probably stank. And you know, they had a much deeper relationship with the animals than we suppose. But I think that's part of the point. It's sacrifices point to the repulsiveness and the consequences of sin. It's a visual enactment of the consequences of sin. And if the sacrifices are more repulsive to you than the sin itself, then I would suggest that you think more about sin. It's not supposed to be nice. That said, God doesn't enjoy the sacrifice itself, and there are a number of verses about that, and I didn't put them on here for to keep it short, but the point is never the sacrifice itself. If you read Psalm 50 and 51, it's about the way in which it's done, sacrifices you did not desire, O God, but a broken and a contrite heart, that kind of thing. Also in Leviticus 5, it's got this eye-glazing number of stipulations about how to sacrifice animals and everything, and then in the end it says, and if the person is too poor to afford an animal, he can bring a tenth of an ephah of fine flour and sacrifice that, and his sins will be forgiven. But I think what we need to understand about the context of sacrifice is, firstly, it was a rural agrarian culture where people raised animals, right? It would have happened anyway. They slaughtered the animals to eat them. That was their food, or part of their food, right? It is also their wealth. It's their money, right? Animals is their version of money. And they are, in a way, offering their livelihood to God. Rather than slaughtering it for own use, they would bring it to the temple. Only a bit of it got burnt, and the rest of it usually went to the priest, because priests in the Jewish culture couldn't own land. You know, there were 12 tribes in Israel, and they were all given a portion of land. The Levites, weren't given land, right? They were in the temple, they were afhanklik, dependent on what the rest of Israel brought to the temple, and that was their food. So they were basically sharing their food with the priests. I also find it ironic that people don't like animal sacrifice, but they're willing to eat steak, because we've just outsourced the gore to someone else, right? And we don't know these animals. It's not like we raised them. They are farmed in a factory somewhere, and we eat them for our personal enjoyment, and not as a sign of we don't sacrifice our livelihood as a sign of our dependence and our thankfulness towards God. So I think if you're eating steak, you can't be too upset about animal sacrifice. The animal killing technology has not advanced much in the last 3,000 years. It's pretty much the same. They stun the animals sometimes these days in abattoirs with something, with the spring-loaded club thing against their head, or with electric shock. Although if you buy halal meat, they probably don't, because it's not halal to do that. If you want to eat halal meat, they usually hoist them up by their hind legs and slit their throats while they're still alive, so they bleed out better. Animal killing technology hasn't really advanced. I think that's what I have to say about it. It's not nice. I'm not going to pretend that it's all okay now, but I think when we see it in context, it's a lot. It makes a lot more sense than when we read it without the context. But you're welcome to grill me on that afterwards, and we can talk more about that. I'm not going to pretend that I have all those answers. Now, between Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve eat the fruit, and Genesis 9, with the flood, it's basically a story of the world spiraling out of control as the consequences of sin develop. So Cain kills Abel, and then there's the Tower of Babel and all these other things, and there's a flood and Noah, animals, blah, blah, blah. And then after the flood, there's this bittersweet, sinister covenant that God makes with humans and animals. And this is as a direct consequence of the fall. We must remember, animal sacrifice and eating animals is a direct consequence of the fall. So this is what it says. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens and upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish in the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I give you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is its blood," which commentators say means don't eat it while it's still alive, you rotten human being. That's what they say it is. Then God said to Noah and his sons, "Behold, I establish a covenant with you and your offspring after you and every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you. As many as have come on the ark, it is for every beast on the earth." For who is it? Every beast on the earth. "I establish with you a covenant that never again shall all flesh, all nefesh, be cut off from by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. I have set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of a covenant between me and the earth." I think that's, it's bittersweet. You know, it's the outworking of the consequence of sin. And it's interesting to note here, I don't know if you picked it up in Genesis 1, all the green plants are given to humans and animals for food, and it's only after the flood that the menu gets opened up. Let's move on. The animal neglect and abuse. I'm going to stick to two very short verses. The one is in Hosea 4 verses 1 to 3, which links animal suffering to the consequences of sin in an interesting way. It says, "The Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. They break all bound, and bloodshed follows bloodshed." Luckily, we've progressed in 3,000 years. "Because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea are dying." Which is quite sad, I think. Next one, Habakkuk 2, verse 17, "The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction or massacre or abuse of its animals will terrify you." Okay, so that's the fall, very, very briefly. And it's pretty depressing. We'll now move on to redemption, Christian hope, restoration, the fixing of what is wrong with the world and what that looks like. And over there, we'll look at Jesus, at heaven first, and then at Jesus. And this is decidedly more upbeat. So, there's this famous passage in Isaiah 11, which you might know. Maybe you don't recognize it from this, but when I read it to you, you will recognize it. And it's a typical Jewish Hebrew poem. And the Hebrew poems are written in this framed structure called chiasm. So the first and the last echo each other, the second last, and so on. And it's a picture of what the world will be like when the Messiah comes. So it says, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse," which doesn't mean much to many people, but Jesse, who was Jesse? He was David's father. So someone will come up in the line of David. Who will come in the line of David? The Messiah, right? The Messiah will come. And what will happen? "The knowledge of the Lord will rest on him." And what will he do? "He will bring about the ideal age." What's that like? 3a and 3b. Firstly, right human relationships will be restored. And secondly, right relationships will be extended towards the animal kingdom. Okay, so this is the Isaiah 11 poem about the coming of the Messiah and what he'll bring about. So what does this look like? The ideal age, right relationships extended to the animals. The wolf will lie down with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child will put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of God as waters cover the sea. I think that's quite beautiful, as waters cover the sea. So clearly this is a poem, and it's got a poetic dimension, and it's got some metaphors and things like that. But I think what we can see here from the poet is that he yearns for a time when this harmony in nature will be restored and there will be no killing, no injury, no predation, none of that kind of thing. And the philosopher Stephen Weinberg, the Christian philosopher, says that to yearn for God's perfection is to yearn for a day when there will be no predation. So if you take a step back, this is kind of the Christian picture of the world. Created good, right? Stuff went wrong, the fall. But we yearn for a time when it will be restored back to not completely what it was, somehow different, but we have these bookends of innocence, they call them. So the theologians talk about the return to ecotopia. No utopia, the perfect, the heavenly place, ecotopia, where the animal kingdom is also part of this restoration of all things. And these aren't just predictions of the future, according to Paul and many Christian theologians. These are calls to action. We can't bring about this ideal age, and we shouldn't think that we are now going to create this ideal age out of ourselves, because we're still sinful and we still do a lot of these crappy things that have been warned against. But they're not just predictions about the future. We are to live in ways that prefigure the covenant of grace, right? That bring shalom, this peace to the earth. Another theologian says we live in the presence of the future. It's the future, certainly, but we live in the presence of the future. We live in the already and the not yet and this tension. Okay. Now, what Balcom says about this is that what we know from the prophetic visions is that it's a new future for the whole of creation, not just for the humans, but for the animals as well. And because we're so closely related to them, if there were a heaven without the creatures, it would be a diminishment of our own human nature, because being human is inextricably defined in terms of the animals around us as well. Okay, so the next one I want to talk about is Jesus. And this is the cosmic Christ hymn in Colossians, which is about this Messiah that restores everything and blah, blah, blah. And it says, He, Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created. All things were created by him and for him. For God was pleased to have his fullness dwell in him and through him to reconcile to himself all things by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. This is the good news that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. This just links Jesus to this, to the messianic theme. And this is what we have to say about the Bible. There's one more slide. I'm going to skip it. It's pretty cool, but we don't have time. So before I go on to the applications, would you like to talk about this? I've been talking for a long time now, and I'm tired of listening to myself. So are there any questions on the Bible before we move on to vegetarianism, hunting, and the rest? It seems that way, yeah. In Genesis 1, it says, Behold, I give to you all the green plants for food, and every seed-bearing plant, and to the animals I also give all the seed-bearing plants. And it's quite a very specific reference, I think, to no predation, at least, no carnivores. Yeah.
Some people, the bad people, eating meat.
Yes. Because we see like Cain sacrificing animals to God, right? And that's, well, okay, that's after the fall. But it's, so there are these echoes of some people were doing it, but it's only officially said in Genesis 9 after Noah. There's a hand back there. Yes. Are you saying we do have the right to take the animal's life? Don't you think so? I think the Bible, at least, does allow it, and I actually have a quote on that in the second half of the talk when we talk about vegetarianism. So I think I'm going to park that until we get to that quote by Karl Barth, because it's pretty powerful, and I think it qualifies it very nicely. But why does the animal have a right to life? In a Christian context, you could say that that God creates the animals. It's you know, God owns the animals, and so we don't we have to be very careful about how we go about that. But let me do the thing about speciesism first, and then So the first point of the application is on naturalism and speciesism. So naturalism is this idea that that the natural world is all that there is, right? It's basically atheism. And speciesism, there's this naturalist called Peter Singer, an ethicist at Princeton University, and he kind of kickstarted the animal rights movement in the 70s in the US and other places by a book called Animal Liberation. And there he says, it's just like it's racist for me to think that I'm better than someone with a different skin color, it's speciesist for me to think that it's murder when I kill a human being, but it's not murder when I kill a pig, right? And that's, why draw the line there? It's arbitrary. The pig, often people say, well, the pig isn't rational. He can't do elementary algebra, and so we are allowed to kill him. And I think Peter Singer quite rightly says that it's arbitrary. Why should we draw this distinction there? The pig has a capacity for suffering, and we, just like we do, and so it would be wrong to allow that animal to suffer. And I actually like speciesism. If I were an atheist, I would lean that way, because it shows that man isn't as privileged as he thinks he is, right? Especially on atheism, we're just animals, right? And there's no reason to think that our species, our animal species, is different to the other animal species in terms of moral status or something like that. If humans have a right to life, animals have a right to life. And it also recognizes that these species have a capacity for suffering, which I think is true. If you've heard a pig squeal, they have a capacity for suffering. But I do think that speciesists are barking up the wrong tree, because I don't think on atheism is any moral imperative to preserve the animal's life. You can't tell me what to do based on your preferences if it's simply atheism. You might be squeamish about blood, but why should I be? If I'm willing to slaughter the pig, then it's your problem if you don't like that. Because there's no moral imperative. There's no one saying what's right and wrong. You tell me it's wrong, but who are you to tell me that? You don't have any authority being an animal yourself. So the other problem I have with that is that Peter Singer draws it through to, he says that dolphins and the great apes have more rights than newborn babies, because they are more intellectually advanced and they have a greater capacity for suffering and stuff like that. So Peter Singer would say it's okay to kill, it's more okay to kill a newborn baby than it is to kill a dolphin or a chimpanzee. And I think he's being very logical there. If this is all you're going on, then sure. He says, he admits that he himself is inconsistent when he puts his grandmother in an old age home, because he thinks that we should kill the aged because they are not really contributing to society anymore, and the mentally handicapped and all those kind of things, because we should be looking after the dolphins, right? Sorry? At Princeton, yes, at Princeton University. So it was very controversial when he was appointed there and stuff like that. Apparently, he's actually quite a nice guy, and he's very clever. He's, yes.
What about the old dolphins, or the aged dolphins?
We can kill them. Yes, yes. The old dolphins are fair game. But I think what he misses is that Mother Nature is not a vegetarian, right? Nature is inherently violent. And if we are simply products of nature, I find it very difficult to say that animals have animal rights in that sense. In the sense that we can say that God created the animals, and animals have speak of their creator and that kind of thing. I think that's a stronger case for animal rights than atheism is. Because atheism doesn't have any... There's no positive vision of what it should be like, right? It's just, don't kill them. But it's not, this is not the way the world is supposed to be. This is not the way the world is created, the way we have in Christianity. And I think it's arbitrary to draw the line at dolphins and chimpanzees when plants clearly experience distress as well, and apparently they emit sounds that are just too high for us to hear. And so, you know, there's this thing, I don't know, there's this funny video about vegetarianism where it says, I don't eat plants because they scream. It's just too high for us to hear. But he makes a good point there, because when I drink antibiotics, I kill a lot of bacteria, and those bacteria experience stress and distress and probably pain, not on the level that they don't have such fully developed neurological systems as we do, but why draw the line at that? So I think it's, and if we want the greatest happiness for the greatest number of creatures, I think we should include bacteria, and maybe plants too. You know, where do you draw that line? I think that's difficult. Brahm? We'll talk about that when we talk about hunting. Okay, so... those animals are precious, I think, but the dolphins didn't start the SPCA, right? It's the difference between us and the animals that gives us the responsibility to look after them, right? The SPCA, by the way, was started by William Wilberforce because of his Christian convictions. He was also the guy who led the fight for the abolition of slavery in England when it was abolished. So the SPCA was started by a Christian because of his Christian convictions. Yeah, so that's why, that's kind of my take on the animal rights thing. I think, can you motivate animal rights without a Christian worldview? That's what I would ask. I know we're a bit over time. This won't take too long still. But are there any other questions about the Bible stuff before we get to eating animals and hunting them? Just short. Okay, Lorraine.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's a valid point. I'm not a big fan of the visual studies ideas, but I think that's a valid point. Yeah. I'm going to skip human and animal charity because we don't have time. Hunting, very briefly. I have good friends who hunt, and these are some of my favorite people in the world who hunt. But the hunting thing, it's a bit weird to me, right? People who hunt say that they love nature. I really hope that they never love me as much as they love nature. My life might be in danger. And people also draw this distinction between trophy hunting and hunting for the pot, you know, hunting for biltong or whatever. Fair enough. I think it's also really weird if you shoot something to put its head on your wall. But you must admit, even if you hunt for the pot, that you do it because you like it. If you didn't, you could buy the meat from the butcher and donate the money to the World Wildlife Fund, and they would spend it on nature in a good way. But there's a thrill in stalking the animal, and if you just stalk the animal and you take a picture of it, it's not quite as interesting as shooting it with a gun, right? So there's something there, right? And I think we have to think very carefully about deriving pleasure from killing things. It's hunting, by the way, is not allowed in Jewish culture because they think it's wrong to derive pleasure out of killing things. They congratulate one another on new clothes. It's like a Jewish tradition. Oh, congratulations, you're wearing new clothes. Except when it's made from animal products. It's not wrong to wear a belt of leather or leather shoes, but you don't congratulate another person on that because an animal has died to give you that, which I think is quite a nice tradition. I also don't see the difference between shooting Cecil the lion in a canned setup where he's drugged in a little cage by a fat American, and getting on a baki with a high-caliber rifle with a scope on it and a tracker and going to shoot the animal. You know, he still doesn't really stand a chance, according to me. If you want to disagree with me, you're welcome to. But the picture in my mind is, if we put you in a fenced-off area of I don't care how many hectares, and we give a hunter a high-caliber rifle with a scope and a tracker and a baki, will you feel comfortable that you have a fair chance in that setup, even if you can run like a gazelle or whatever? I don't think it's, you know, he's going to shoot you with a high-caliber rifle from 100 meters away because it has a scope on it. You know, there's something funny there. But we have bigger fish to fry, so eating animals. Put that in there. The Bible clearly does not forbid the eating of meat. We saw that, right? But we are slaughtering 1.2 billion animals a week at the moment. Well, that's the number I got. 1.2 billion animals a week. We have an obsession with meat, right? And we look at animal sacrifices in the Old Testament and we go, oh, that's primitive. Oh, look at those people. But we, you know, we're okay with buying a little non-cow-looking piece of steak in Pick and Pay. We have to admit that eating animals is not a picture of heaven, and it's not a picture of the way the world is supposed to be. So the famous example is, would you eat a Labrador for breakfast? Or, you know, a nice piece of German Shepherd? That's gross, right? We're repulsed by that. But we're willing to eat pigs. But pigs are more intelligent than dogs. Why are we willing to eat pigs, but we're not willing to eat Labrador? Because we have Labradors as pets. That's the only reason. And we have formed some emotional relationship with an overly loving Labrador at some stage in our lives, probably. But I think we're being inconsistent there. If we are okay with eating pigs, we should be okay with eating pets. Okay? Cole Barth has this quote, and this is the quote I wanted to get to, Bram, which you can throw up here. Cole Barth, for those of you who don't know, is probably the most influential theologian of the 20th century. And he is... no one, I think, agrees with everything he said, So you are welcome to disagree with this, but I think it's pretty powerful. He says, the killing of animals in contrast to the harvesting of plants and fruits is annihilation. This is the removing of a single being, a unique creature existing in an individuality which we cannot fathom, but also cannot deny. The killing of animals presupposes that the peace of creation is at least threatened, and the animal itself constitutes a continuation of this threat. The nearness of man to animals irrevocably means that when man kills a beast, he does something very similar to homicide. And I lost my place. We must be very clear about this if we want to maintain our lordship, if we want to maintain that the lordship of man over animals carries with it the freedom to slaughter them. If there is a freedom of man to kill animals, this signifies in any case the adoption of a qualified and in some sense enhanced responsibility. He obviously cannot do this except under the pressure of necessity. And I think this is where the animal rights thing comes in. It's like you don't shoot people. If you shoot people, it's murder. If you shoot people in self-defense, it's at least very similar to homicide, right? But you can do it under the pressure of necessity. If we never treat this need, he must never treat this need for defensive and offensive action against the animal world as a natural one, nor include it as a normal element in his thinking or conduct. Because remember, it's a consequence of the fall, right? Killing animals is a consequence of the fall. He must always shrink away from the possibility, even when he makes use of it. It contains the sharp counter-question, who are you, man, to claim that you must do this in order to maintain, support, enrich, and beautify your own life? And then a second short quote by him is, whenever man exercises his lordship over the animal, especially across every hunting lodge and abattoir, there should be written in letters of fire the words of St. Paul in Romans 8:18 concerning the earnest expectation of the creature for what? For the manifestation of the children of God. So I think this, he creates a very good context here in which we kill animals, right? Always in enhanced responsibility, always asking, does this animal have to die in order to maintain, enrich, and beautify my own life? And I think we don't need to kill 1.2 billion animals a week in order to do this. So I'm not going to talk about the environmental cost of eating animals, the health cost of eating animals, except maybe to say this, and I'll finish with that. I'm sorry for taking so long. There's a verse in Philippians which says, don't let your stomach be your God. And if vegetarianism offends you because you like meat, you like your biltong riku, then we must be very careful about letting our stomachs be our God. Right? I think eating animals was an allowance that God made after the fall. The world is broken, right? It's a necessary evil. But I don't know how necessary it is anymore. We have access to a wide variety of fruit and vegetables and nuts and seeds and legumes and all sorts of things that the average first century Galilean Jew didn't have, right? They basically had their sheep and they had fish and they could grow some grain, some wheat. We have a wide variety of food. We can get a lot of our nutrients from the food. I don't know if you speak to people like Valdu, I think he would be able to convince you that you can get everything, without eating meat, everything you need. Some dietitians I know say that you can't. I know a bunch of vegetarians who seem to be quite healthy and haven't died yet. So, and they look good. They look young, really. Like, do that for 20 years. I know them from the Mountain Club. I'm the Mountain Club. Bunch of wacky people. But those people look so young, and many of them are vegetarians. And I wonder if there isn't some link there. I myself am not a complete vegetarian. I have to admit that. I'm not, like, pontificating something. I eat meat, like once a week. And, yeah, we try to make it free range and that kind of thing. Although, free range doesn't necessarily mean ethical. But yeah, we're close-ish to vegetarianism, so maybe I'm biased. But yeah, I think I'll finish off with you can't lead the horse to the water. You can lead the horse to the water, but you can't make it drink. So now you can grill me, or let's have a discussion. You don't have to ask me a question. You can make a comment or say something. Can we have the mic, maybe? If there was a question here, and then there's a question at the back there.
Do you think the South African outrage at our rhino killing is inconsistent with our appetite for steak?
That's a good question. I think it's a meaty question. It is, yes. I was waiting for one of those, Yaku, from you. Yeah, the poaching thing has got a lot of other elements to it as well. Like, how dare they go into a nature reserve and hack off the horn of something which might or might not be dead with an axe. You know, it's gruesome, it's grim, it's for a bunch of Chinese people who think that it's going to help them have better sex, which is just, you know, stupid on so many levels. But so there's that as well. But I agree, we've lost, I don't know how many rhino, a couple of thousand. During this drought in that we're experiencing now, they've slaughtered 40,000 heads of cattle in KZN. Now, those are, I think, a lot of rural people's cattle that were depending on them for milk and stuff. But it gives you an idea of how many cattle we have in South Africa, and guess where they end up on our plates. So I think there is some inconsistency there.
And just a comment, in the book of Daniel, when Daniel and his three friends are taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, they actually become vegetarians because of matters of principle, and that actually helps their health. I don't know if that has any bearing on anything, but...
That is an interesting thing. I know some other churches in Pretoria do a Daniel fast, where they become vegetarians for 40 days, which is funny. I'm not a health professional. I can't give advice on that kind of thing. But my vegetarian friends seem pretty healthy, and I think they sleep better at night. There was a question in the back there, but okay, go for it.
I understand that humans can healthily lead a vegetarian life and get all the nutrients they need, minus all the cholesterol and everything. But how about other carnivorous animals? Like, if you have a dog or a cat, what goes into dog food is all the cuts of meat that people don't want.
I came across this last week, cruelty-free pet food. So there are these people who try to feed their cats a vegan diet. And I have a friend who is a vet, and she posted this thing on Facebook that said, if you feed your cat a vegan diet, I will bring a skull of a carnivore to your house to show you that it should eat meat, and then I'll proceed to beat you with the skull. That's a difficult one. I think if you have a problem with that, then maybe you shouldn't have pets, or you should feed them other kinds of pet food. But I don't think you should feed cats a vegan diet. That to me is like completely wrong. I don't think it's wrong when a lion kills a zebra either. It's his survival. He's not eating straw like an ox yet, and I don't think the straw like an ox thing is a scientific a description of the science of what happens when Jesus comes. I think it's a poetic description of the ideal age. But I think you should feed your cats meat, preferably ethical meat in some way. I don't know. That's difficult. But feeding it like fruit and nuts. There was a girl at the back there that had a question, Niku. No, at the back. Back. Sorry. Yeah, I know. Not yet a woman.
So just a comment. Is it working? I don't think that atheism precludes compassion. For instance, I know many more vegan atheists than I know vegan Christians. Compassion, I think, is a universal thing, and it can apply to any kind of culture, any kind of religion. So that's one comment. Also, if you take into account what animal agriculture is doing to the world, to the ecology of the world, it's one of the leading causes of all kinds of environmental ills, then we are actually destroying much more than we are creating through this. And what kind of religious perspective would condone that?
Yes, I agree with you completely. Firstly, to our shame, I think there are many more non-Christians who care about animals than there are Christians. And it's, I think, mainly because of the way we've been taught to read the Bible about the dominion of man over the animals and that, those kind of ideas, which I think, I hope I showed you, is not biblical, is not a good interpretation of that. So I agree with that. I don't think compassion is an exclusively Christian virtue. Yes, you don't have to be a Christian to be a good person or anything like that. But to me, it's about the reason that you do that. So you are compassionate towards the animal, and that's I applaud that, but why? If we're all going to die anyway, and we are just dancing to our DNA, I don't find a moral imperative to be compassionate. You can, I think, when atheists are compassionate, they recognize something about the goodness of creation. But I think it's inconsistent with their thing. On the second point, and you're welcome to comment on that afterwards. On the second point, I left that out here, but I have friends who are doing masters in environmental studies and things like that and have gone vegetarian, not for reasons of animal cruelty, but simply for environmental reasons, because the environmental cost of eating animals is so high. Half the world's farming land is used to grow food for the cows that we eat. So they slash and burn in South America, for example, the Amazon rainforest, to open up areas for cattle farming. And then after a while, the soil gets depleted and they slash and burn some more. So, there's a social cost as well. There's a lot of people who don't have enough food to eat, and we're feeding half of the world's grown food to animals so that the rich people can eat the animals because the poor people can't afford it. And I think there's something very wrong there about the way this whole thing works and our demand for meat. It's wrong on many different levels, environmental, social, ethical, etc. Would you like to comment on that?
No, just that's my point. I agree with that.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a question and a comment on maybe how we look at animal sacrifice and how we look at pain. I think we might be too worldly-minded, maybe. And when life is in God's hands, when we draw that line in death, animal or person, God still holds that. And eternity versus this world, maybe the distinction we make in this world the killing, a killing being made, or death happening, that death gets defeated in any case. And maybe we're too worldly-minded and instead of looking at eternity. Along with that, looking at sacrifice and pain in this world, that for me is a reminder of the fallen state of this world, and that should point us, in my opinion, to that. Because even we as humans, we choose pain. If we want to birth a child, there's going to be pain in that process, but our intention is to create life. Even knowing you're bringing a person into a life that's going to be full of pain and hurt in a fallen world. So I think there's more to be said that we need to challenge our minds to look at the redemption state. And I think you did it beautifully by pointing out a perfect world, a fallen world, and that fallen world, what it implies. For killing and eating, what's the intention behind all of that? And that it is not perfection, but that we need to find a way through that and understand that the intention is not the pain, but the purpose behind it.
I think that's very well said, yeah. I was thinking of Legends of the Fall the other day, the movie Legends of the Fall. I don't know if you've seen it, Brad Pitt, there's one scene where he fights a bear or something and he chops off the bear's nail, right, and he hangs it around his... He, he's like around the tree and he lops off the bear's one finger, and that's part of becoming a man for him, because he's this, okay, Brad Pitt is a white guy being raised, half raised by this Indian shaman dude, and he's taught to have this respect for nature. And I was thinking, is it really cruel when as this rite of passage, he fights the bear and he gets the nail? Is the bear going to go, there's so much pain here, you know, this is wrong? I think there's something, and then later, you know, when he slaughters, when he does slaughter an animal, he takes its heart and he buries the heart, and there's this whole reverence for the life of the animal thing, which is pretty pagan on the one hand, but also I think quite interesting in the reverence for life, and the fact that I think we are obsessed with death in a way we shouldn't be, as you said. I don't think death and pain are necessarily the criteria according to which we should measure everything else, being Christians. So I said what you said, just worse. Anyway, go on.
Edmund, just a remark that I sort of want to make is, you had that verse up there where God speaks to Noah after the fall, after the flood. And I think that verse for me personally, or that part, is my go-to reference for when we talk about the right to life, for both humans and for animals. And it's very, very important to me, because it also has a lot to do with how I personally tackle the problem of pain in the world. You know, a lot of people would object to the idea of God being loving, because, you know, you get natural disasters where millions of people die that an all-powerful God could possibly have prevented. And because of that, when you go and read the passage where God talks to Noah after the flood, he says that, you know, I'm going to give you all the animals to eat, and it's fine, you can do it. However, you are not allowed, and I don't think you had this up on the screen, however, you're not allowed to kill another person. You're not allowed to kill another man. And I can't remember the exact wording, it's quite powerful, but he says, I will demand a toll from anybody who kills another man. And he even goes further and he say, any animal who kills a man will also be in very big trouble. And so for me as a Christian, the reason why I'm not willing to kill Gyorir is not because I believe that his life is, you know, somehow holy, or he's got this ultimate right to life. The reason that I don't do it is because God told me I'm not allowed to do it, and I believe God is the ultimate holiness, so I must listen to him. And I think the modern view on the right to life is that, you know, we've got human rights, all of us have certain fundamental rights that must be respected, and in a way that's the ultimate reality for many people. And I think in a secular world that's fine, that's good enough. But now it gets wishy-washy when now you're starting to talk about animal rights, and like you say, where do you draw the line? Because is our life really worth more than the next animal that's more intelligent than my grandmother? So for me, it's, well, I'm not allowed to kill my grandmother because God said I can't. I am allowed to kill an animal because God said I can. However, like you said, it's also important to take care of the animal world like a good ruler would, and not like some crappy ruler.
Thank you, Pika. Valdi wants to say something. Oh, boy. Hello.
Okay, a few thoughts. Okay. Like, for me, it's obviously a no-brainer. If you eat meat, you're wrong. I wish you had shown just a few clips of factory farms.
I considered some very gross clips of humane animal killing. It's still very gross, but...
Yeah. Yeah. But in a way, like, especially for Christians, for me, slavery is wrong, torture is wrong, rape is wrong. So, like, you know, the atheists put Christians to shame, and also, Soos ons gooi ons Christelike waardes uit net omdat 'n stukkie vleis of biltong vir my lekker is.
Ja.
Soos doen aan ander wat jy nou self gedoen wil hê. Dis en wat sal Jesus doen? Ek dink as Jesus vandag hier was, sou hy nie vleis geëet het nie.
Ja, ek wonder, ek dink hy sou nie.
En ja, ek weet nie, dit is vir my flippend frustrerend. Want dis soos mense soos ek weet nie hulle maak of grappies oor veganism of as jy vegetarian of wat ook al is, maar jy weet jy's verkeerd. Soos jy kan nie 'n goeie argument maak om vleis te eet.
Ja, that's the other thing I wanted to say. Can you come up with a good reason for eating meat? That's what actually Peter Singer, he was sitting at Harvard or wherever one day, and they were serving steak in the dining hall, and the guy next to him ate everything else and put the steak aside. And he was like, what are you doing? And he said, no, I don't believe in eating meat, having something else die for my pleasure. And he asked Peter Singer, can you give me one good reason for eating meat? And Singer was like doing a master's in ethics or something, so he was like, oh, crap. Huh. And that was the last steak he ever ate. It's a good question. Is there any good reason for eating it? And are we just letting our bellies be our gods? Are we just allowing our tastes to dictate our morality? And do you think that in 100 years' time, people will still be eating meat? I wonder. Maybe, probably, some people. Anyway, Bram.
Okay, it's a good question to ask if in 100 years people will be still eating meat. I've tried the vegetarian thing for a week. Not happening. So, what I will tell you is that the killing will continue because the balance is already disrupted in nature. Elephants, they will literally kill all area. They will pluck out trees.
That's what they're doing to the Kruger, yeah.
They need to be culled.
Yeah.
That's the long and short. That's the reality of it. Same with the antelope, same with any species on Earth. Take the story of the rabbits back in Australia. Mm. That wasn't supposed to happen, but it did. Yeah. So they brought in the cats. The cats is a problem. The rabbits are better now. So still, the killing is necessary.
Can I say something? Are you finished? Can I say something? I think there are 11,000 or 12,000 elephants in the Kruger, and they are destroying the place. I like the Kruger. We go on holiday there quite often, or to areas around there. And because of the way people have put up watering holes for the tourists to see the game, the elephants have multiplied rapidly, and they are destroying the place. And it's very politically incorrect to cull elephants, so they can't do that. So they're looking at ways of sterilizing 11,000 elephants or something like that, which is ridiculous. But it's a direct consequence of human intervention. Take away the watering holes. Not so many tourists go to the Kruger. They don't have money for nature conservation. But they're looking for natural ways of doing that because all those examples you mentioned are examples of humans interfering in nature and disturbing the balance. And maybe killing to curb the numbers in cases such as those would be the way to go. I'm not actually against that. We have to, because if you don't do it, it's more inhumane to leave them. But those are questions that we need to look at and try to answer creatively and positively first, I think. And if we can't, then we have to do what we have to do.
Okay, guys, because I've got the mic and because I want fellow biltong eaters to also come back, I just want to ask one more question, then we're going to end of the night. And that question is, if Jesus ate lamb, do you think he cared for the lamb that he ate? And if so, is it possible then to eat meat and care for whatever you've eaten? And Valdo, let's take it outside afterwards.
That's a very good question. I don't think Jesus was a vegetarian in first century Palestine. There is something. I think Jesus, as the creator of the lamb, does have some, does feel something for the lamb. But I'm wondering whether with the means at our disposal today, if Jesus were here today, he would still eat the lamb. And maybe he would. I would submit to that correction. But I think we need, I think we need to think very carefully about that answer ourselves.